In 2022, Dean Carlin walked into USAID as chief economist, tasked with moving US foreign aid towards approaches the evidence said actually worked. He left 2.5 years later in 2025 as the agency was being dismantled. In his time there, he and his office moved roughly $1.7 billion of funding. And in today's episode, we're going to cover what the push for evidence-based policy actually looks like within institutions and governments, the growth of evidence labs in developing countries, and whether we reach a point where we stop needing more research on a given approach or topic. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev, and today I'm joined by Dean Carlin. Dean, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me here today.
So I wanted to start with your time at USAID and your experience trying to push aid towards evidence-backed approaches, and then we'll broaden out the conversation after that. You've spoken about this experience already on other podcasts like Statecraft and In Pursuit of Development, which I'll link to in the show notes. And on those episodes, you've spoken about how you were able to move about $1.7 billion towards evidence-backed approaches, but that does leave billions that you weren't able to move. I guess reflecting on that, was it just a case of not having enough time, or were there other insurmountable barriers that you were coming up against?
Fair question, because the reality is it is a small proportion. It's a proportion we were both proud of and also sad at the same time, since obviously it ended up crashing down to zero. There were institutional constraints, but also there's knowledge constraints. There's a lot of things we don't know. That is one of the strangest things I find about being a professor, is that I get asked a lot of times as if I'm supposed to know stuff. And yet I chose to be a professor because of the research, because of recognizing the knowledge gap of what we don't know in this world and wanting to help contribute to learning things that can help then guide policy. So my first instinct in most situations is to start by fearing how little we actually know and trying to see what is the evidence that is out there and where can we generate more evidence, right? The move to do what we were doing at USAID could not have been done 20 years ago. There has been a wealth of evidence from a broad community in development economics that has produced a ton of information about what works and what doesn't. It doesn't mean that all questions are answered by any means, because there's a lot of us that are still out there being the professor who's willing to admit that we don't know stuff and we want to learn. So there were a lot of things USAID was doing that I would say, if someone said, what is the best of the evidence on how to do that well, I would have been very uncomfortable making any sort of strong assertion. Yet at the same time, the goal of what they were doing and the logic of what they were doing may have been defendable or not. So there was a lot of areas that we were careful to tread carefully on and not overclaim the ability for evidence to inform. But yet there was a lot of areas that USAID was working in that were spot on to where the evidence base is. Trying to address food security, trying to improve primary school learning in schools. These are things that the evidence base is actually fairly strong on. Having said that, there's also a recognition that even when there's really good evidence for something, that doesn't mean that you get to declare it from the mountaintop. This is the best intervention for that. Now go do it everywhere, right? There still needs to be a strong attention to what do you need to do to implement that program over in this place? How do you adapt it? How do you decide that that's the right context in this place? That localization and contextualization process is a lot of what we were working with people at USAID on, is to try to see when there is a global evidence base that can be used, how do you use it over here? And so that process does take time and requires going country by country and team by team and doing that work. So that's part of the reason why The 1.7 at some level is big, but yet still small. The other is just institutional. Look, the reality is we started and there was no team. We had to first build a team. We had to first create an office. I didn't even know what that meant when I first started at USAID. And I quickly learned that there's a process for that. It requires Congress to not veto it. So we had to go through a process where they were putting holds on it, and we had to learn what do we need to do to answer their questions in order to help them understand what is it that we're trying to do and what is it that they're concerned with, and how do we ameliorate those concerns. And then we had to hire people, and that too was not an easy process within government. We actually raised philanthropic money to support the office from philanthropists who recognized that if they didn't help us, that it was going to take 2 years before we could hire staff, and then we were never going to achieve any institutional change in any sort of timely fashion. And so we spent a fair amount of time fundraising. We spent a lot of time working through the bureaucratic process to hire and go through all that. So in that sense, I'm not at all, I don't feel at all that I was still, that's the sense in which I was quite proud of what our team was able to do to get to the 1.7 billion number by a mere 2 years.
Yeah. So from what you're saying there, then the main barriers, I guess, were that the evidence wasn't there for some areas, which meant it was hard for you to come up with a list of best interventions, and that also you had to build the capacity of your own team, which in a short time period kind of took up a good chunk of that.
There's two things I want to just clarify and add. One is there were areas where the evidence was there and it supported what was happening. So we didn't need to touch that. We don't count that in our 1.7 because we... So a lot of things in global health were of that nature, things in PEPFAR, for instance, which has been heralded in many, many contexts. And that is delivering medicine. We know the medicine works. You might quibble about the method of delivery and whether it's the most cost-efficient way of delivering the medicine and building state capacity to onward support health clinics and things of this nature. But the basic idea of the medicine and the protocol that the global health team was providing support for has a really strong evidence base. We stayed away from that. Why? We wouldn't touch that. We don't want to get we don't want a false claim and work on it just for the sake of adding our name to a list and then adding it to our list. So that's an area we didn't touch. The other caveat I just want to add is that it is the case that there were a lot of areas where the evidence base does speak to it. It's not that we were hamstrung in knowing that there is evidence out there. But one thing that it did help me realize is that there was a gap from what the evidence is that sits in academia and what the policymakers and the donors, donors in this case, need in order to make a plan for their money, like write a request for proposals. And that mapping from one to the next, that was missing. And that's part of what our team worked on.
Great. And yeah, we'll get back to that gap with a later question. I guess one thing I wanted to ask about was your approach to moving funding and how you worked with people who were already kind of funding specific aid programs to maybe adjust what they were doing or try something new. I guess from what I've heard you say on other podcasts, which I mentioned before, the approach was kind of relatively collaborative. And you tried to bring teams with you and kind of show them what you were thinking and why you were recommending kind of changes. I guess an alternative approach would have been a more prescriptive one where you kind of just simply told teams, okay, no, you need to cut this and do this and that's that. Maybe that would have required more powers than you had. But do you think that type of approach would have been more effective, or are you still... I guess a fan of the collaborative way that you went about things?
I remain a fan. Maybe we could have had a bigger short run number, but we would have had a worse long run number. And I think it's important to play the long game and build the state capacity for ourselves as well as for our partner countries where we're supporting. And so, but you're also right in the way you alluded to, like that wasn't a choice I was given, to be perfectly blunt, right? So at no point did I was I in a room where I was able to sit there and propose, well, can we just do it this way and ignore everybody? That was just never on the table as an option. And I think, like I said, I think that's actually healthy. The change that we're seeing now did do that, did say, well, let's just scrap everything and build from scratch. Although I'm not sure build from scratch is the right way to describe what I hear is happening. But, you know, there is money that is flowing out, but it is going out in like big chunks. So it's not a question of building internal state capacity. So, you know, there is a blank slate now, and that is a striking that there is now an opportunity to really put in place a good aid system that is better than what we had before. Everybody at USAID would have said there's problems, but that's true of anybody who works anywhere, right? Think about your own workplace. Like, of course, there's always things we can point to. No one ever goes home every night going, my God, I work in the most efficient, well-run organization, firm, government ever. Everything's smooth and everybody gets along perfectly. That's just not the way anything is. We all think there's ways of improving, and USAID was no different. Some areas were better than others.
And how exactly would you work with people then to say you picked a team or a sector where you were going to go in and maybe make some recommendations? What would that process actually look like?
So we had a two-prong approach. One is best described as an in-house team of consultants. And the second is some of the more institutional process changes, regulatory changes, culture changes that we were trying to do. But the first is where I'll focus my answers, and that's more directly hits on what you're asking, which is we looked for three things. The first thing to recognize is when we landed and we were able to put out some descriptions of the kinds of things we were doing and what we were offering to USAID and the logic and the thinking and the evidence base, we were greeted with open arms from a lot of people across the agency who were eager for that kind of change. They saw that problem, they saw it historically, but they didn't feel empowered to change the system in that way. And they did see that this was a big charge of the administrator and the deputy administrator, and it was very important to them. That's part of what got me to come. And they saw this as a moment in which change could happen. And they reached out when we landed, in a sense. And so we were overwhelmed with a lot of people who were of the mindset that we were of, wanting to see change as well. We then had three things that we looked for whenever we were, in a sense, vetting an opportunity. One is, how much is the money? Because we only have so much time ourselves. We had a limited team. So we had to think about our cost effectiveness, not just the cost effectiveness of USAID. We had to think about our leverage. We have this many people, and how much money is it that we're going to be able to move? And there were things that I found intellectually very interesting that I was learning about, carbon markets as an example, but that USAID was really not that engaged in making awards that were feeding into the system. And I had to do the, you know, sane thing and the logical thing of backing down, even though I was very curious and I thought there was an opportunity there to try to improve something, but I had to step back. So we looked for where there's big pockets of money. We looked for where there was a delta, as in, is there a change that we think the evidence might be able to inform and make happen? Are they already doing something that's proximate to what the best of the evidence has to say? Or are they in a space that we think the evidence maybe doesn't have much to say at all? And so in either of those cases, we would not engage and make false claims and overstate our confidence of the evidence. Now, if it's an area where evidence could be generated, then we would bring in our evidence generation team and work with them to say, you know what, this is an important gap of evidence. And we as an agency could help improve the state of knowledge on this area. So let's do some better evaluations here so that we can all learn, is this working or not? So that would be what we would do if we thought there was a big gap between what knowledge could bring to this space and what is happening. And then the third is, we needed a willing and eager partner. Because at the end of the day, the way USAID worked was most of the detailed decisions about how the money actually got spent actually was in the hands of people living, the foreign service officers and foreign nationals working in the countries in the USAID offices and across the globe. And those are the ones, those were the people who actually controlled what is actually going to go into that request for proposals. What are we going to ask implementers to actually do? And so they needed to be part of they need to be the integral to the process. And if someone there is not enthused with making the changes that we were describing and using evidence in the way, there are too many ways for them to, in a sense, undermine what we were trying to do. Take our advice in one stage and then ignore it in the next stage of the process and make us give us a false sense that it worked. And then we find out in the next stage that the work we did went away because they moved to something else. So if they're not bought in, then that was a recipe for disaster. No, we wanted to change the incentive system so that we would bring in more people and shift those incentives and provide career rewards for people to be following the evidence in that way. But that fits more into that second category of things I was describing about the institutional change.
Yeah, and following up on what you just said about needing a willing partner, I guess part of that, which is something you've spoken about before, is that you saw your team's role as essentially accepting a sector or country team's goals as given or not trying to affect the actual overall goals, and then essentially trying to help teams achieve those goals more effectively. I was wondering kind of how far you took that, because it strikes me that this is a similar approach to what Stefan Dercon has referred to as this second best approach, where essentially you take policymakers' goals as given, and then as an economist, if you want to have impact, what you do is tell them how to achieve their goals in the most effective way. But it seems like it has to end at some point. So were there or are there goals or sectors that are so ineffective or even counterproductive that you would simply kind of step away and say you're not going to be involved?
That's a fair question. And let me say one positive thing, which is this is exactly why I was prepared to stay on into a Republican administration. I was not a political appointee. The things we wanted were popular on both sides of the aisle among the wonky of the wonky set, let's say. And in fact, in many conversations, the wonky Republicans are actually more supportive of the kinds of things that we were trying to do, with kind of being a little bit more hard-nosed on measurement and impact and walk away from things that are not working, even if our heart really wants it to work. So we were prepared to stay on. We didn't know what the changes were going to be. We our best guess was that there was going to be broad sector areas. In fact, I don't think this was much of a guess, but I mean, it was well informed by things like reading Project 2025, that we would see gender efforts go away, we would see climate efforts go away. And to your point, like whether I think that's good or bad was, you know, could be informed by economics and cost benefit analysis that tries to make comparisons across areas. But ultimately, for USAID, those decisions were made by Congress, not by USAID. And so that's what allowed me to take that focus of saying these are decisions made by Congress, both in the countries that we're going to focus as well as the sector areas that we're going to focus. And it's a very complicated grid of the intersection and the way that all worked out. And that actually was a saving grace for us, avoiding those issues altogether. Now, if we were working in an area where we really thought the goal was a genuinely bad goal, then I agree we would need to face that. I was never called in to work on a cause area where I thought the aspiration being set was genuinely bad for society. So I didn't face that. What would we have done if that were the case? I would like to think we would have figured out like how to bring the evidence to bear to help make that point clear to the parties that were there, and that odds are high that there'd be some way of maybe the way that's being defined, there'd be some way of letting the evidence help guide towards the modification to the goal to help make it be positive. So there weren't cause areas per se that I would say we were engaged in where the best of the economic evidence says this is actually a bad idea for society. issues did arise, though, where the economics would sometimes say, hey, that particular goal is actually not doing what you think it's doing. So one example that came from some of the macro engagements that we found ourselves in had to do with credit ratings of sovereign debt. And there was sometimes an effort, and there's been some articles written, popular press or policy arguments and cases made to say, hey, let's push the credit rating agencies to score African countries higher on their credit rating because their cost of debt is so high. But if the credit rating is higher, well, then they can borrow for less money. And this is a way of trying to address the sovereign debt crisis that a lot of countries found themselves in, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. As a matter of economic theory, though, that's flawed. If you literally use political pressure to alter the way a credit rating is, the market is going to recognize this and then put less weight on the credit ratings to begin with. And that itself then creates more of an adverse selection problem where investors don't have a reliable credit rating to use. And then that would actually lead, in theory, to harder to borrow situations for countries that have high risk because the investors have a hard time telling the determining what the risk level is of the countries. And so the theory models behind that aspiration suggest that that's not a very healthy aspiration. Like, we need to instead help the countries manage their debt better, do planning better, collect more tax revenue. We need to work on building their state capacity within the ministries of finance rather than trying to change the credit rating if we want to try to help tackle the sovereign debt problem that a country is having. And we did have a team of people that were working on just that, working with working with ministries of finance in different countries to help guide and improve the way they were managing scenario planning and forecasting and tax collection.
We've talked a lot about kind of your experience at USAID, which is obviously on the donor side. Ultimately, evidence really moves the needle, though, in development when evidence-based programs are scaled up by governments themselves in Africa or Asia or Latin America. One innovative approach here that I'm interested in hearing a bit more about is this embedded labs model. I was wondering if you could tell us kind of what the setup of those looks like and what they do day to day.
Sure. So for what it's worth, this was the biggest word on my 2025 bingo card that I would have lost miserably on if we actually played 2025 bingo. And the reason for it is fairly simple in the backdrop, which is to recognize that USAID was the largest bilateral in the world, $50 billion a year or so in aid around the world. And yet USAID was tiny. If you compare the budget of USAID in any given country to the budget of that country. And then this is even more so if you think about foreign aid from other entities, from a philanthropist, or even just from another bilateral that's not as large. It's even true with the World Bank, which is obviously bigger than USAID, but still smaller than the budgets of local government. So ask the basic leverage question. Rather than saying, what's the best way we can use our money in the provision of direct services? Instead ask, what's the best way we can use our money to help influence and improve the way local government uses their money? And that knock-on effect creates leverage, creates much bigger impact if successful. If not successful, then it could create less and be multiplied by zero if it failed to change the way the local government is moving their money. So it's a riskier prospect almost by its very nature, because you might be taking the same underlying program, which has its risks of whether this program will or not will work in that context, right? Because we don't ever know whether something works. We just believe it's going to work based on the evidence. And that belief gets more and more, we get more and more confident about that belief, the more data we have, the more contexts we have in which it's tested. But we never know, right? So there's always some risk, but now we're adding risk by making ourselves one more removed. In trying to influence the governments, but the promise in terms of the leverage is huge. So I do think in net, it's a no-brainer. It's also important in the trend that we're now seeing. I think trend maybe is the wrong word for it. It's the break that we're now seeing, where there's a huge interest around the world. In fact, even the term foreign aid. I've been in many gatherings in which there's lots of talk about the fact that we're going to stop talking about foreign aid and we're going to stop talking about development cooperation, right? And the idea that the local government is the partner in the journey for development, and we care about this journey from the wealthy countries, but that it is ultimately a partnership of which they need to be in command at the helm of that ship, guiding what is happening in their country for the process of development. So it is in that spirit that we instead of asking, you know, what's the program that we ourselves should scale based on the evidence base, and let's just go hire contractors to then scale this. Instead, it's what does government need to decide for themselves what is the best approach from the evidence that's out there? What of the evidence that's out there fits for me? That's the first step. So that's in the sense doing the same evidence kind of use and review that we were doing at USAID. The second step is what is the data needed internally to manage better what they're doing? And some of that might be setting up randomized trials to measure the impact of a program, but some of that is actually just better data to manage their programs. Think of yourself as like running a major sales operation on something and needing data on how much people sell and, you know, how many doors were opened, doors knocked on, sales made, things of this nature. And you need some of that same operating data if you're going to run a Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, everything from school attendance to test scores to stockouts of medicine and things of this nature. So that's the second piece of it, is helping to just build the data infrastructure to help manage good large-scale operations. And some of that might include randomized trials to measure impact. But then the third phase is being quite deliberate about innovation. And this is where a large donor like USAID can add money to the ministry's budget to pay for large-scale pilots of new approaches, right? And let that be the budget of the large outside donor to pay for improving the state capacity of the ministry, alongside funding to actually pay for the extra intervention, because that might be the constraint that hits a government, right? If a Ministry of Social Protection has a cash transfer program and it's already operating at scale, it's already taking up the full budget, and then someone comes along and says, hey, why don't you try this other approach other than cash transfers to try to achieve your goal? Their first reaction, understandably, is going to be, well, are you proposing that I take people off of the cash transfer program in order to fund that? Now, how is that going to work? So adding money to their budget to pay for the innovation is a wise path for the large donor like USAID, World Bank, et cetera.
On the embedded lab model, I guess I was wondering if you could talk through maybe some specific examples of that, where countries or governments have started or founded one of these labs, these evidence labs. Maybe expand on whether those efforts have been successful or effective.
Sure. So first of all, there's a few different components that typically make up what we refer to as a evidence lab, but it's not cookie cutter, right? Just like the evidence needs to be adapted and contextualized, the concept of a lab needs to be adapted and contextualized to what is happening. So I'll give you two examples. One is from Rwanda and one is from Peru. In Rwanda, both of these are education. For some reason, which I'm not, I should be finding a good answer to this, but I don't know. There's more in education than I think we've seen in other sectors. But we have seen them in environment. We have seen them in health. So they do exist outside of education. But these two examples are education. And in Rwanda, there had been a randomized trial done on teacher incentives and the compensation scheme for teachers. And it produced innovative, interesting results that indicated that this is there's a better way of incentivizing teachers. And then the question came, how do you do this at scale? How do you build this into the country's overall operations? And so that's where the lab began. It came out of that one study, as I understand the origin of it. But the first step was really about building the data infrastructure for the Ministry of Education at scale to be able to know attendance and test scores and use that for a multitude of purposes that are not just about the compensation scheme, but that are also just about a superintendent or a district head being able to know what's happening in my different schools. Where do I have attendance issues for teachers and for students? Where do I have test scores that are languishing or variance that's going up where some students get much better and others stay low? They can actually see some of that data in order to be able to react and manage schools better. But that also becomes the data that are then used for a scale up and further testing of how do you compensate teachers better. And so that's the part that is collaborative now with the government, helping them walk through the process of learning on a question that they're forming and they're asking about how to manage their operations optimally. And so that's now reaching all of Rwanda and demonstrating huge impact by implementing the policies that have been tested at smaller scale and knowing that now that policy is hitting all of schools. In Peru was more focused on the innovation aspect. So in Peru, the initial process was, here's some additional funding to pay for innovations. And so we have a few different goals that the we here is really the government ministry. And then we brought in a team of researchers who had different interests, and they worked together with the ministry, coming up with different ideas on how to address the problem. And then 14 different randomized trials were conducted with the ministry, testing out different ideas. And from that, three different ideas rose up, working really well to achieve the goals that they set out to achieve, and have now moved into being scaled throughout the country for the Ministry of Education in Peru.
And I was reading your upcoming piece on aid for the Journal of Economic Perspectives. You talk about the labs in that paper, and you also say that the academic policy gap is smaller than often claimed, but larger than it should be. I guess the first part of that statement surprised me, at least, as my feeling is that development economists still probably underestimate the gap between the questions they ask in their research and the questions that policymakers in low and middle income countries ask. I was wondering if you could expand on why you think that gap is smaller than claimed.
First off, I may be wrong. Let me be clear. That's not an easy thing to measure, right? To claim like, oh, I think it's 17. Let's go find out. Oh, it turns out. So, but there were many cases that I saw firsthand where there was a goal, and there was a lot of research that was out there that did actually fairly well speak to that goal, and yet it wasn't getting used. Right. And so that's the that's the sense in which the gap was not that big. But the reality is, I understand from the perspective of the in our case, Foreign Service officer, who is the one that needs that evidence, that it wasn't that there was something I could turn to say, here's the one document you need that you can have total confidence in, completely summarizes the literature and delivers to you what you need to write into a call for proposals for funding, and is going to answer your questions that are local to your country that you're going to understandably and rightly have about how to contextualize and adapt this program. So that gap was definitely there, but that gap is actually not as big as I think it's often perceived to be. And so part of what we were doing in our team was very clear, trying to identify how can we cleanly say what that gap is. What are the six questions or 10 questions that we need to ask to go from, hey, teaching at the right level is this great program that works for primary school education learning outcomes. What are the 10 questions we need to ask to know, is that the right solution in this country for the problems this country's primary school education is facing? And what are the questions that you need to ask in a request for proposal in order to elicit information from potential contractors on who understands best what needs to happen to implement this and run a successful program?
Yeah, and could you expand a bit on the gap? So you talk about the kind of two parts to this gap. There's the synthesis gap and the implementation gap. I was wondering if you could run through those kind of quickly.
Sure. So the synthesis gap is we don't reward meta-analysis enough in economics, in my opinion, or in social science more broadly. Meta-analysis, which just has a kind of decently well-defined inclusion rule. We will include the following research if it includes the following criteria. And then we get that full set, and then we're just going to take the, we're going to stick it in some Bayesian model or just random effects model or some sort of econometric model, take the number that comes out of it, and voila, there's our answer. That is more the style that we often see being done in public health or medical space. One example that I saw years ago in the deworming context, when public health looked at what's the typical impact of deworming pills on helping to get rid of intestinal worms and its impact on school attendance, which was as the economists know in the audience of this, or it was part of the research that was behind Michael Kremer's Nobel Prize in 2019. And the two things were striking when we saw the kind of analysis coming out of the public health space. One is throwing away studies that included iron. There was a study that was thrown away. Whereas an economist would look at that and say, well, can't you just model the iron effect and build that into your model and have a more theoretical model about the impact of deworming on constitution and strength of physical strength, and then from that onto education. But no, instead the study gets thrown out. Same thing with looking at things like the spillovers, which was actually the key insight from Miguel and Kramer's work on deworming. And again, the economist looks at this and tries to build a model that is then estimated through a collection of studies, not just having an inclusion rule. Here's the 17 studies, we include them and we take the average. So, but we don't see the synthesis we need that in economics that does that, where we are collecting as many studies as we can that are on the same topic, and then quantitatively trying to put a model together to help understand what are the patterns we're observing, when does it work and when does it not, and what does that tell us about some underlying understanding in terms of the poverty and development space. And what we tend to do is we write review pieces that are qualitative in nature. It's actually a little bit odd, if you want my opinion, because it's like we are a very quantitative oriented discipline. And yet when it comes to synthesis, we shudder at the idea of being too quantitative. And instead we want to take our 17 papers, which we think are telling us something, put them up on the wall and then stare at it until we see a pattern and then talk about that. Which I appreciate, and don't get me wrong, I think the world needs to triangulate and we need that. That is a very important kind of way of thinking about the knowledge in a space. But I think it needs to be complemented as well by looking at the quantitative data and figuring out better ways of aggregating that quantitative data. So that's lacking. And what ends up happening is we all, and this is true of policymakers, it's true of donors, it's true even of us academics, we put too much weight on any one paper that reports on an impact of or some policy question in one place. And if it's a donor, they put weight on the ones they pay for, right? Which is crazy to think that who paid for it should be the driving force that determines whether you listen to that evidence or some other evidence. If it's us academics, we put too much weight probably on our own study. Certainly we put too much weight on the study of someone of what we happen to know about, or whether it's top five published versus not top five, we put too much weight on that difference in terms of what we're going to say is knowledge that we've now learned. These are all different angles that feed into the same basic problem, that we're not doing enough aggregation of the evidence that's out there. That is the kind of aggregation that should then be used to inform the policymaker, inform the donor about what to actually do, rather than the kind of the one-off study and the one-off interaction through a conference and through an interaction that says, here's an interesting study, go do this. A second thing that we don't do is when we write a paper, we like to think that we're taking a theoretical question and we're using data to try to then answer that theoretical question. And that question is usually framed not as, did it work? Not in a just strictly program evaluation way. Now, as I think we all know, one can take a program evaluation question, did it work? And just be a bit more nuanced and theoretical about how you phrase that. And yet empirically, it's the same thing. You're still just asking, did it work? Right? You're just putting some kind of structure underneath that and some theory behind what you're claiming. But a lot of times that push for that more narrowness means that when you're writing the paper, you're not actually writing the paper with a mindset of a implementer picking up that paper, finding out that it worked, and then wanting to go and do it. And there's things that we leave out because of that, because we're taking a focus on a theory. And I wouldn't propose that we change the way we write papers over this. I think the way we write papers is healthy in that regard. The way we write our appendices can improve. The fact that we can include an appendix that says, here's everything that went into the things that I'm not going to talk about in the paper since it's not relevant for my theory. And yet they were actually part of what happened. And so if you're an implementer and you pick up this paper and you're finding out that something worked, and the paper is talking about some theory about why it worked in some very narrow way, that is important. But you want to answer these other questions. So an example I use for this is, I've done a lot of work on the graduation program in social protection. We have a recent paper that's published in American Economic Review Insights that pulled together three different studies that all tested using groups versus individuals to do coaching as part of this program. And so that's what the paper is focused on, is the group versus individual aspect of this program and comparing that. But ultimately, of course, there is an element where this paper is reporting three questions about, did this program work? And yet the program had other pieces to it. It provided cash transfers. It provided access to savings through savings groups. It provided training on some livelihood and information. And those are mentioned very briefly, right? But if you were an implementer and you picked up that paper and you said, well, these are some really exciting treatment effects, I get it. I should do group-based instead of individual. That message is clear from the paper. But it doesn't tell you anything about how to do the savings, how much cash to transfer, why were those amounts chosen? And I'm not saying we're going to be able to write an appendix that explains everything literally in like a full, where that's all you'd have to do is read that paper and off you go. But we could have written a lot more about all the decisions that were made in the design of those programs and why they were done that way, and left that as an appendix, even though that's irrelevant for the question that the paper was written about.
Yeah, and even if it ends up in the appendix of a paper, it definitely should be front and center, I guess, if you're writing an article on VoxDev or publicly for kind of a policy audience, because often I think academics just jump to talking straight about effects. And if you're a policymaker reading that and there are these impressive effects, then I guess your next question is, well, okay, how is this actually done? And often that's kind of relegated to a few sentences just saying this program was implemented without actually going into the nitty-gritty of that.
Even a pilot is a good example too. A lot of times we don't write about the pilot, and there could be an appendix. Here's the pilot. Here's what we tried and it failed, and here's why. And then we tinkered and then we got it to this and then we did that. And that can be very informative for a group, because for some other group, maybe that pilot would have been the better approach. And it would help them to see that. And they would say, oh, but that failed for a reason that's not germane for me. Maybe I should try that.
There's definitely a lot that doesn't make it into the main body of a paper that is actually still just really useful information for a policy audience. I wanted to ask a follow-up on, you've been already talking a bit about the meta-analysis work you've been doing, and you have a paper on cash transfers and more recently graduation programs using kind of the meta-analysis techniques. I saw you present your work on cash transfers, I think maybe around this time last year, and you made comments along the lines of, look, we probably don't need another RCT on the impacts of cash transfers on households. We often talk in development economics about where we need more evidence, where there are evidence gaps. But is it now the case that there are areas where we already have enough evidence?
I think everything's relative, because everything has a trade-off. So there's nothing out there that I would say we should ever be so confident of. We need to always have some humility and some humbleness about how much we know about something and our levels of uncertainty. But there are some areas that we have less uncertainty than others. And that's the key, is trying to figure out where those areas of uncertainty are. And yeah, with the 117 by our last count randomized trials on cash, comparing cash to no cash, we see such consistent results, and we see so little evidence of some of the fears, almost none, that I would say if I'm in a context and someone is saying, should I just do this? The answer is yeah, go ahead. Having said that, I'm working on some cash randomized trials. Why? Well, because how we do it, how it's done, is still a very big open question. In cash, one of the big open questions is, what are the macro effects? Same thing with graduation. What is this? This might look great at small scale. And by small scale, I do mean, like, that could include like heavy penetration in small areas. So that's been done and that's been tested. What I mean is, when you hit the country as a whole, what is going to happen that might be different? Are you changing the structure of markets and how they work? And what are the macro multiplier effects that take place? So we saw really exciting work by Dennis Egger and team from Kenya that has really whet the appetite of a lot of both micro and macro economists to come together and figure out, okay, how do we learn more about these effects at that level of scale? Because the evidence is so strong at the micro level that it is getting enthusiastic response from groups that have the resources to do it at a country level. So we really need to understand that better. And then there's other questions just about how to roll out the cash better, that are just about whether cash should receive a kind of cash plus, whether there's nudges to attach on top of the cash that can be done for little to no cost extra to help improve the way the cash works. So that's something that I think of as a big gap in our knowledge that is important to work on. So there's always some space. I don't know that there's any area that I would say is, you know, without any need. Even when we look at the medical space, right? That might be an extreme example where we might say, we don't need another randomized trial of that medicine. We know the medicine works. But we likely still have lot knowledge gaps about how to help that medicine get into mouths or shots into arms, right? And so most things, even if the whether it works or not is known, there's the how it works that still needs more work.
To finish on that, if you were kind of the general manager in charge of development economics, I was wondering where currently you would be trying to push research in the direction of. And I was also wondering if you had any thoughts on how that can actually be done. Where can work, or how can work be redirected to where it adds more value, where the marginal value of a paper is going to be higher for the policy world? Is it a question of funding, incentives, something else?
So I'm really glad I'm not that person. And I say this because, look, there's a lot of exciting work going on. It is really exhilarating to go to conferences. There's a conference that I started attending about 4 years ago, the Evidence Summit run by SIGA in Berkeley, that was really exciting just to see. Not just, there's a lot of randomized trials being done, whereas 30 years ago, if I attended a conference of that nature, I would see next to nothing. But it's not just the randomized trials. It's even the non-randomized trials are answering really important, exciting questions using appropriate approaches. And we're seeing so many different sectors and areas and broad engagement in just building more evidence towards answering questions. So last thing I would want to do is ever be, I'm really glad that I'm not in a position, and I don't think anybody is, to really be a dictator and say, you know, this sector and that sector, because the world's a big place and we all work on things that we find interesting for idiosyncratic reasons. And some might be thinking deep and thoughtful thoughts the way you're asking me to right now. And some might be doing it because it's just what they find personally interesting and rewarding. And it's because I work on education because I grew up in a family of teachers, and that just resonates for me. You know, having said that, I would go back to what we said earlier, and I would say I do see often two gaps in some of the questions that get tackled. One is the synthesis, and we need to see more of that. We need to see more work to work on some of the methods issues that make that easier to do. I mean, one of the biggest bottlenecks that we find when we're doing synthesis work is that we measure things differently. Now, some difference in measurement is important and a consequence of being thoughtful about what you need in that country, in that context to measure. But some of it is not. And some of it can be improved by having better guides to what we can be measuring and how we can create more systematic measures so that we can do better aggregation of evidence. And the other is a strong focus on how things are done, not just like, does it work, but the inner workings of organizations and the inner design of programs to figure out what can be done best. And that goes right back to the embedded lab aspect. That is one of the goals of the embedded lab, is to help build evidence teams within the countries that are really dialed in on thinking hard about how to implement the policies they're implementing. But this is true of nonprofits. It's true of for-profits as well. It speaks a lot to a presidential address from Esther Duflo from about 10 years ago, maybe, called The Economist as a Plumber. And I would encourage people to go back and look at that. It's a piece that was at the time pushing us in a direction that I think we've now seen many go, but we need to do more.
Thanks again, Dean, for joining Ideas in Development. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also subscribe to our new Substack. All of our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.